Good afternoon, everyone. Hello, and welcome to One City, One Story at the Boston Book Festival. I'm Alicia Anstead, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this eighth event for the One City, One Story. Eighth for Boston, seventh for me. I couldn't be happier than to be a part of this amazing discussion. I want to tell you a little bit about our format today for those of you who are newcomers. How many of you have been to the One City, One Story once before? Well, welcome back, and welcome everyone who's a newbie. We love having you here. This is a very interactive session. Your voice is as important as any other voice in the room, and I hope you'll add it to the conversation as we move on. The way that we organize this is the first part is a conversation among us in earshot of Daphne Kaloute, our special guest writer today who is with us, but she's just in observing mode right now, and we're in active mode. After we talk for a little while about the story, Daphne and I will go on stage and talk a little bit more, and then we'll open it up to your questions directly to Daphne. So that's our format for today. And I'd like to just get started. I should mention, too, because I will forget at the end, that there is a book signing afterwards. Is that correct? And where is it? Thank you, Madeline. So if you're planning to have something signed, your story, something else you'd like Daphne to sign, a check, whatever you got, you can negotiate with her on that. But let's get started. I assume that you're here because you read the story and you've been thinking about it. And I just wonder if we could start very simply with what are some of the themes that you think this story touches on? And it's going to be hard for me if you just shout out to catch you on a mic, but just this first time, sorry, John, just this first time, let's just shout out, what are some of the themes that you came upon in this story? Go ahead, just write out.
Survival.
Death.
Other
connection.
Sorrow.
Denial. Holocaust.
What's the sacred?
Naming. Up here, there was one. Resilience, life, aging, Babcock Street. Certainly setting is important to this story. In the back, sir?
Duty.
Others back here? Anyone out back in the back? Wanna?
Intergenerational.
Hunger and food.
Other?
The continuity of sorrow.
Lubricating levels. Well, I look forward to hearing more about that. What else? Anybody else have a different theme that's come up?
Healing.
Compassion. Certainly empathy. Kind of a companion word to compassion.
Good death.
And bad death. Mm-hmm. Other themes? Are there characters who stood out to you? If you have a character who stood out to you, one that resonated with you that you've thought about after you read the story, just raise your hand. Just raise your hand, a character that stood out. Who stood out to you? And I am going to hand you the mic.
I've forgotten her name. Sorry, Daphne. the grandmother, the older woman.
Rose.
Yes,
Rose.
That's right. Yeah, I love that character.
Right, so she's really one of the main thrusts of the story.
Yes.
Go ahead, sir.
Ruby.
What about Ruby?
Just the sort of Schrodinger living dead kind of there, not there.
Right. Ruby has an interesting way of entering the story, doesn't she? Because you're thinking, oh, he's thin because since the baby was born, right? And your mind goes in one direction, right? And then what happens, there are a couple of words that give us, I mean, that passage is actually worth looking at. Let's just look at it. I think we're looking at page 7 is when we learn about Ruby.
We must give her a name.
Yeah, that's where we begin. So what we hear after that is each breath. So right now we have a living baby, right? The living baby, and then the tiny creature. What name would not overwhelm her? And cruel joke. And then it had been explained to them why. That passive voice, you know, and you begin something, some little kernel begins to turn in your head. Something's askew here. It's a very difficult passage. It's a very sad passage. And yet, I think that ruby has a resonance, but it's really connected to Rose too, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Other characters. And what stood out to you about the chaplain?
He just came at a magical moment.
Right, he came at a magical moment. And what happens with the chaplain? What happens in the room with the chaplain? Anyone want to? These are hard topics to talk about.
He reflects their feelings.
He reflects their feelings. He witnesses also, doesn't he? Which I think is another theme in the story, the theme of witnessing someone else's hardship and trauma. Other thoughts about that? Oh, go ahead, Madeline.
He understands the beauty of the baby.
And he names her. She's a gem.
He's a gem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, right. Other images that resonate?
Well, I was talking about duty before. The chaplain comes in to do his duty.
Right.
But then he winds up having deep feelings instead.
Right. But one could argue that that is his duty as well. Right, if not all of our duty. Madeline, can I call you back here, please?
It's his duty, but he has probably performed that many, many times, but it shows that he's not inured to it.
Right, right. And he's also very young. There are a couple of locations in this story, right? What are some of the locations of the story? Okay, so Boston. Boston, where else? Mass General. Right, lots of locations
Star
around
Market,
Boston.
Star Market, sort of.
Yes, right, sort of. There are lots of Boston locations, but there's also Germany is resonating. Where else? Switzerland, right? That's Al Linder, right?
Yeah.
Who's not Jewish.
Right,
right, right. 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 And also the chaplain, California.
Oh, I missed that.
Right, so there's a whole other level of setting and location happening. What else about the story? Are there moments in the story that felt like they mirrored something you recognized, whether it was a neighborhood or an emotion or a tone or something that you recognized in your own life, in your own setting? Any thoughts on that? You're mumbling. Are you arriving or?
Oh, I mean, you know, at the age where, you know, parents are passing on, and a lot of the memories that come back to them, and they talk about it, you know, as if it's, you know, as if it's happening in real time.
Mm-hmm.
So
I kept wondering to myself as I read, does memory ever go away? Does it ever, the memory, I mean, there's the one woman in the story who begins to talk in German, right, to her husband, and she's talking about the SS, and it comes out in German, you know, and, I mean, memory lives in its historic place, doesn't it, in our bodies? Yeah, yes, sir.
It felt to me like the spiritual center of the whole story was Emily Dickinson's tombstone, Called Back.
Called Back.
That really both kind of took me back to the beginning of the story and on toward the end of the story.
Right, Called Back, and
yes.
And the main character in the story has some response to that, doesn't he?
Yes.
He feels that he wishes he could have that assured faith that the chaplain and that at least the gravestone has.
Yes.
Right. Go ahead, ma'am.
Well, I was just thinking back earlier. The competition about who had it worse that never has crossed my mind, and yet that's human nature, isn't it?
Right.
Even if you're suffering, you want to be able to have done it the best or done it the most or something. I mean, it was bizarre, but I understand. Yeah.
Did it cause you to reflect on whose trauma was the biggest in this story?
Well, and what? Yeah, I didn't think so much about who, but just what the different kinds of trauma that we experience are not always, like you say, they're implying at least the greatest are not necessarily the ones that you would expect to consider the greatest. Some of the simple losses.
Right, right. And at one point there's a listing of, you know, once you've been to this camp and you've had a hip replacement, you know, I mean, there's that. You know, in the midst of this very sad story, and to me it is a very sad story, it's not without humor, though, right? And I think that that somehow makes it palatable to us as well. Go ahead.
The helper needs help, and it feels like we all take different roles at different times.
Right. So sometimes the person who's going through loss is the person going through loss, and another time he or she may be the person expressing witnessing or empathy. Yeah, that's a really good point. Go ahead.
I was really struck by this questioning of expertise, like who is an expert on life and death, because our very first phrase in the story says, according to the notes in her file, and then the story proceeds to present all this contradictory evidence.
What do you make of that? I'm so glad you brought up that first line. I went over that first line so many times. What is happening in that first line? What is happening in that first line? Anybody want to speak to that? Oh, you're going to really challenge our running shoes today. Hang on.
According to the notes, this woman is on her deathbed or she's dying, but this woman is 99 years old, has made it through the Holocaust, and is still going strong making meatloaf. So despite what people say, she is a life force. And it does say her life's journey is to be a long one. And it does juxtapose with this poor baby who only had 5 days, but
right.
She's allowed to give the comfort. But that's what it says, you know, according to the notes. But she may go on another 5 years.
Right. There is some tension between the paperwork and the living thing, often true, right? What do you make of the meatloaf? Anybody want to say? Let's get some new voices in here. How about some new voices? Go ahead.
I love the meatloaf. I felt like even if we're supposed to be the receiver of help, it was such an ability to see him. Like he said, like he was like, how did she notice I needed food? How did she notice I had pain? And to do something for someone else and to become alive because of it.
Right.
And her story about the onion.
Yeah, right.
I just realized, you know, it's just so connected to it.
She ate the onion.
Shearing the onion healed her wounds.
Yeah.
And shearing the meatloaf becomes, I don't know what sort of magical dish.
Right, but that onion has some resonance, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, when we talk about, I mean, I'm going to be kind of silly here for a second, but when we talk about onions and peeling back the layers, right, and what you wear when you peel back the layers of your own life to heal. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm going to say the title, the whole relativity of discussions about death, depending upon whether you're 76 to 99 years old versus whether you're a young person. The assumption seems to be that the discussions with these elder Holocaust survivors are going to be about dying and about things related to that, whereas, you know, Rosa would sort of rather just live life at 99, whereas Robert needs to talk about death. He needs to talk about it, and there's no obvious sign. Like when you're 99, it's obvious that maybe death is a conversational topic, but when you're his age and you don't know his background, you don't know that. Rose is perceptive enough to see something, and then finally Robert gets to share, and it's like he needs that. As a younger person to talk about that, whereas, again, the older population in general, it's like, you know, we'd rather do something else, and please not have the conversation about death.
Right, right. It brings me back to what one person, I'm sure many of you thought about the theme of reconciliation. What does it mean to have been in the Holocaust and to be facing reconciliation, and is there any resonance for reconciliation for Katie and Robert? Is it, can you reconcile with nature, you know? Go ahead.
Just a funny meatloaf reference. We just went to visit Eleanor Roosevelt's Valkill cottage, and we learned that she served meatloaf to everybody who came, no matter who it was.
It was very healing, I'm sure. Yeah, right. Moria.
My favorite thing about the meatloaf was when Robert held it up over the doctor's head when he was leaving, and he kind of made a connection with her that was more personal than...
Right, right. That's kind of like, Doc, I don't really like you and all your nice, you know, he's a well-suited guy, and poor Robert feels so intimidated by him.
And it was like her triumph, because she had made this for him.
Right. Yeah, the meatloaf feels like a little miracle, doesn't it? Yeah, yeah. Let's go over here and up here. Anyone?
And the words the author used to describe the meatloaf, I think she said it was soft and yielding. And I think yielding was such a great choice of words.
And that's such a beautiful way to be in the face of someone else's loss, to be soft and yielding. It's a lovely description of kindness under those circumstances. I mean, I suppose there's not all circumstances you want to be soft and yielding in, but that's certainly one of them. More observations about the language in the story. How would you describe the language in the story? Any thoughts on that? Say it again. Well chosen. There's one word that recurs three times in the story, and it took me about three reads to get that, was marionette. Her body was like a marionette. Do you remember hearing that straight off in the beginning, then in the middle, and then in the end? Such an interesting word to repeat. That's about the baby, right? Yes, yes. It. Anybody make anything of that? Anyone else note the presence of those descriptions to dolls or marionette?
It was born without hands and feet. It's right. Shocking.
Right.
Because you think a child might just be born with some incomplete system or mm-hmm. brain disease.
Right.
Really, really incomplete.
Yeah, he does say she was very ill. Yeah. Right. Right. I'm going to try getting this to you.
Well, marionettes and puppets are both operated by others. And so really the story is about these two individuals who everyone else believes they operate, obtaining their own skills to operate their lives, even if it's only a five-day-old life. She has life in as much as she receives a name.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice read on that. I should also say that sometimes I think as writers, as treating us, like marionettes are puppets, that we are their puppets, and they're taking us on this journey, which gives me just the most wonderful opportunity to welcome Daphne Kotelet to this stage. Great. So, Daphne, welcome.
Thank you.
Congratulations,
so much.
And thank you for your work. Thank you for your writing.
You.
And
thank
your
you
insights.
All for reading, I must say. Thank you.
These are sinking chairs, I have to say. Daphne, what's it like for you to hear people talk about your work like that?
It's so moving, I have to say. Thank you. It's so rare that we get to hear feedback in the moment from somebody. Can you not hear me? Okay.
Thank you. Thank
all
you.
All right. I'll move it
stage
here.
Voice.
Yes, so thank you. It's very rare to hear immediate feedback and from so many people at once. And it's very moving because also this is a sad story in many ways and very close to my heart. So it's especially nice to see people thinking about it and discussing it. I'm glad you're here.
We're all glad you're here. We're glad you're here. John, can you turn her mic up at all? Is there anything that she can do to adjust it? Or that you could do, or we're good? Okay, thank you.
Right.
Let us know if you can't hear, okay? Mm-hmm. So, Daphne, you know, we've been talking all day today in many panels about how people do what they do when they call themselves writers, whether they're poets or playwrights or novelists. And I'm always interested in where the art begins. Where does the story begin? Mm-hmm. Could you give us some insight into the provenance of this story? The idea, how you developed it, and how it got finished.
Sure.
And is it finished?
Sure, yes. This story, I think the first kernels of this story began in 2013. And then the first time I tried to write it, I think was in maybe 2014. And then when the little elements came together, it was 2015. And I'll say specifically what I mean by that. So first of all, the character of Roja is based on my grandmother, who I will first say she died last week.
Oh.
This is important. I want to say she was in Canada where they have physician-assisted dying, and she did that. And my sister and I had been saying she was 100.
Oh, my goodness.
And we kept saying she was really becoming physically very decrepit and uncomfortable. And even at the end, it was, we said she would probably live for another 4 years, even with all these things piling on. So in 2013, I was giving a reading up in a university not far from her. So I thought, I'm going to drive over and see my grandmother. And she was already having physical ailments. And we actually, there was an exchange where she was like bedridden and basically was like, bring me the coupons and, you know, with, go get all this food. And which she's always been like any grandmother, wanting to feed me. And to be honest, I had to leave out the more comic lines from reality because they sounded slapstick, which were basically, you know, my friend Sheila, she did Weight Watchers and she's had 2 strokes. Watch out.
That's a great line.
I had that voice and this sort of funny situation in my mind, and I started to kind of write those exchanges down, but I didn't have a story.
So hang on, I just want to interrupt you there,
sure.
Because I don't know about you, but I'm not, you know, an artist. So I'm always really interested in the window onto that. So when you say, I kind of wrote things down, but I didn't really, what do you mean you wrote them down? Phrases, scenes, characters, what did you write?
Yes, I wrote into my computer, I typed in this exchange about Weight Watchers, about, you know, watch out, you need to eat. Bring me the grocery circular, you know, go buy this. And I just had it in there thinking, I don't want to forget this.
And why did you write it down?
Because I just thought this, it seemed to say so much about my grandmother, the situation, and also the inherent kind of comedy that's even in a sad situation, which was somebody who's physically is actually deteriorating, but really still caring for me. I mean, I went there to visit her, but she was, you know, I'm worried about you, right? There was no reason to worry, but she, you know, that was her, that was how she was thinking. So so I wanted to get that onto the page. And then I, basically 2 years later, a very dear friend of mine died of a long illness, and I was very sad. And I went away to write for a week, and I happened to meet a woman who told me that she was a social worker for Holocaust survivors. And I said, that's really interesting to me. My father's a Holocaust survivor. My grandmother's a Holocaust survivor. I didn't know there even was this service. And I asked her about it, and immediately my mind, I just started thinking about all the people she would meet and all of my family members. Everything in that story, in this story, all the different characters' stories, even people we don't really see, we just glimpse. I mean, I took that all from different people in my family, where we had people surviving in different ways and not surviving in my family. So all of those stories and then all the weird ways that directions that people go after a tragedy like that. In my family, I have people who became very religious and outspoken and wanted to talk about what they lived through. And I also have people in my family who literally never, like one cousin of my father who never even told her husband that she was Jewish, not even let alone what she had lived through. So the silence and then the wanting to share and restarting life after losing people. So I just started to think about that provider and that caregiver, and somehow that I think that he could be suffering in a way that we often have our own suffering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a real continuum of suffering, you know, in this story. But, you know, I think wrapped in such beautiful prose that we trust you, that you're not going to let us fall too flat with that. You know, it's not a hopeless story. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really key. So it sounds to me like you had a lot of dispersed elements then, that somehow this through line of Roja, is that how you say her name?
Yes, it would be
okay.
Roja.
Yeah, yes. I'm sure lots of people mispronounce your name, mispronounce her name. But in any case, that she seemed to be the through line. through the story then. Well, Robert as well.
Yes. I knew that somehow she was at the heart of it, and I didn't know what would happen. And I, that was also just in terms of process. When I had this idea about names and that Robert and his wife would be trying to think about to name their baby, I didn't know what the name would be at all. And I was playing with this idea of the Puritan names and the names that we give to strengthen people, and I thought it would end up being one of these Puritan names. So that's where I was going with that. And then I wrote the scene with the chaplain, and he said that about that she was a gem, and I thought, oh, that's her name.
That's so interesting. He said that. This character said that.
Yes, I was envisioning what I wanted him to be overcome with the beauty of this other life, and what would he say? And I was picturing this little being. Mm-hmm. So that's how that happened. I surprised myself.
Right. I mean, we know that when writers pull from their own lives, that it's almost never a direct parallel. That there's, you know, you tweak and you shape and you make it into the story. But you did mention, and it stuck in my head, that the person you met who visited Holocaust survivors was a woman,
yes.
And you made the character in your story a man.
Yes.
What informed that decision?
So now I can't remember exactly, because I'm thinking, well, if I knew that, it might have had something to do with the fact that if a baby had died, I thought it shouldn't be the mother. It could be that I just thought that would be a whole other layer.
Yes.
And I didn't want that. But I can't remember if I consciously thought that or that might have been it.
Apropos of that, there is that moment in the story where I guess more the narrator than anyone recognizes that Robert fully felt his fatherhood in those 4 days, those 100 hours. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a very beautiful moment, sad, mm-hmm. deeply sad, and that pairing of sad and beautiful is something you do particularly well. I felt that was a very generous moment on your part as a writer and a thinker,
Thank you.
Recognize that it wasn't just the mother in that situation. Daphne, what are you striving for in the short story form?
I think stories are particularly good at looking very intimately at a moment, at something that might be otherwise overlooked. Often in novels, we're trying to tell a much broader story and our gestures are grander, and I think stories are so wonderful for pausing to get a glimpse into something, you know, a very small exchange between two people, or a little insight that a character has, and I love that about stories. I love that you can take something kind of mundane, you know, from daily life and just open it up a little bit and look at it a little more closely and see something maybe surprising and beautiful because you've taken the time.
And I suppose that all art that is successful is precise, but the short story and poetry in particular thrive on precision.
Mm-hmm.
How much longer was this story when you first wrote it?
That's a great question. It definitely was longer. I mean, I love cutting and paring things down. So it's funny because sometimes people will say, well, how many words a day do you write? And often my whole work for the day was taking away words. So it never gets longer. And even when I'm adding a page, I'm probably subtracting a page. So, like, I worked on a revision of a story the other day, and the page count never got longer by the end of the day, because everything I was adding, I was taking out other stuff.
Mm-hmm. And what are you taking out, then? What do you see that doesn't work that you take
out? So, kind of details that have already been expressed one way, and it seems like overkill. Often it's just language, the wording of a sentence that can be said more concisely. And consolidating moments.
And how do you police that? Do you share it? Do you, are you just, I mean, you, we were talking before, we came onto stage. Daphne's teaching creative writing at Princeton right now, but she has a long history of teaching creative writing, which always kind of mystifies me. I teach writing too, but not like that. You know, it's journalism. And I mean, that's really something to try to teach someone to be creative, you know, and so how do you police that in yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I'm an impatient reader when I think something could be said more clearly or more elegantly, or, you know, you already expressed that in the scene. You don't need to show it again. I'm impatient when I'm reading things like that. Mm-hmm. I think, oh, come on. So I guess that's just, for me, the cutting never seems problematic. I'm never really wedded to things in my work, and I'm okay tossing them away. But I will say I give all my drafts to my friends, and many of my writer friends are in this room right now, and they've read drafts of this story. And they read drafts even after it was selected to be this story for this event, where I said, all right, people are going to be reading this. Can you please let me know if there's anything that I can make, you know, any way better? And there, we still cut things at that point, actually.
Is that true for those of you who are in the audience who are writers? How many of you share your work with friends and rely on them for feedback and and editing?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's always, I would never think to ask a friend to read one of my articles before I published it in the newspaper or wherever it gets published. It just, but creative writers really support each other that way, I think, many of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not a method that works for everyone. Mm-hmm. When we began today, Daphne, we heard a lot of themes of what people were, you know, latching onto in the story. Mm-hmm. Which of those resonated with you?
The idea of human connection, of people being compassionate and empathetic, and also death and birth. Because when I think of this story, I thought, well, it's about these really big mysteries in a very kind of small, or I say mysteries, but kind of magical things, being born and dying, and then this sort of mystery of human cruelty in the case of the Holocaust, but then of human kindness in the case of these providers, these social workers, and then, you know, Roja being kind back to him.
It seems to me the cruelty of nature, too.
That's true. That's right.
Because
I didn't think of that.
They're both grieving for loss, and one of them
it's
would have been
physical,
controllable,
yes.
but it wasn't,
yes.
And the other one completely was not controllable.
That's right. I didn't think of that.
You know, the range of that grief.
Mm-hmm.
But there was another topic that came up that I thought was also interesting, and it slipped my mind now, but it was along the healing lines. I mean, I think once you've experienced loss, it does change you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can change you for the worse, that's true. Mm-hmm. But if you're lucky and mindful, it can change you for the better,
mm-hmm.
even though you wouldn't choose that path,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Why did you set it in Boston? Curious.
You know, I've lived here so long, and I was picturing... Somebody said, oh, Babcock Street. I mean, I lived on Pleasant Street for so long that I walked by Babcock all the time. And I don't know. I just had, then I taught at BU for a long time. So I was picturing that area. And I don't know. I could picture it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
I mean, location is such an interesting thing because all of those places, I'm not from Boston. I've lived in the area for 10 years and I still don't know the nuances of the neighborhoods here. So when somebody says, oh, I'm from ta-da, you know, and I think, okay, great, but I don't know what it means. And I'm sure that those of you who are lifelong Bostonians could talk about the texture of each of those mentions in this story in a way I couldn't, but I could grasp the totality of Boston, and that the minister was from California,
mm-hmm.
you know, a more open
mm-hmm.
heart.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not to say that Bostonians don't have an open heart. you know, but just talking about what these locations mean. I mean, are you thinking of each of those details in that way as you put it all together?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I knew with the chaplain, I wanted him to be young and carefree. just as a contrast. And I knew I wanted the sort of Puritan through line in the story, this New England kind of buttoned up, you know, not being so emotive. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and then I just was thinking about the neighborhoods that Robert would go to and sort of what would it may, I don't know, I just picked places I could picture him going. Mm-hmm, so. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say about the writing of the story, the place this story holds for you as a writer, or how you'd like people to think about the story?
Thank you for asking. You know, I think of this as a fairly traditional story with these parallels, and the old and the young, you know, somebody, yes, and somebody living, and somebody's life never really takes off. And that, in terms of the writing, you know, it's, so it's a simplicity. I hope it comes across with a seeming simplicity and naturalness, but just that, yeah, it took a long time. It's that it was many years of figuring out, and maybe not even consciously realizing that that's what you've set up, but can I write about big, maybe heavy topics in a way with a light touch, mm-hmm. And that isn't overbearing and isn't maudlin? And I wanted to try and write about those topics, and I'm really pleased that the book festival didn't think, oh, readers don't want to read about something that's heavy, or oh no, we have, because I sort of thought, well, what if they don't like that people die in the story, a baby dies, you know? Mm-hmm. But I like that they recognize that we read because we want to enter into people's lives and these things happen.
I think there are plenty of entry points for us that aren't that heavy. The infallibilities in the story of the doctor's better looking than I am, you know, just those vulnerabilities, you know, that go through the story. That lovely moment when the chaplain comes in and Katie speaks to him, you know, just those moments of I think of them as moments of eye contact. Mm-hmm. Through the story, mm-hmm. you know, like a moment when people finally actually look into each other's eyes, mm-hmm. and see each other for the pain or the joy or this moment, whether it's pain or joy, I'm with you. I am with you in this moment. And that witnessing, I think, is something that's so profound about the story. Mm-hmm. I'm going to walk down into the audience and move the microphone back, okay. So that we can open the discussion up to the audience again. I'm not going to mic run this time, so if you have a question for Daphne, because I don't want to leave her up there on stage, I'm feeling very vulnerable myself now talking about all this loss. If you have a question for Daphne, if you would just come up to the mic, and let's make sure that everybody has the chance to ask a question. Maybe some who haven't had the opportunity to step up to the mic.
Rose with her, Ruby with her 5-day life has the perfect name, and so many of the elder characters switched names, had names changed. I'm guessing that wasn't just coincidence and that there was some point of interest that you wanted to make, and I just would love you to talk to that.
Sure, yes. I mean, I think so much about people being remembered is about their names, and I hear this comes up even today. I was actually talking to my roommate, and she said, you know, all 4 of my grandparents were Holocaust survivors, but we don't know, she said in some cases, I don't even know who people's names were of her own family members. When my grandmother died last week, my aunt, who's my father's sister, found a document that had the names of my great-grandparents on my grandfather's side. My grandfather died in the Holocaust, so my aunt had never known the names of her grandparents on that side. My grandmother had never mentioned it, never told her, and she found it. She said, I know their names now. So it matters, you know, and I'm even thinking last week with all the, you know, Trump's call to the wife, right, and people kept saying, well, it's because his name matters. Did he say his name? And I understand that. It's part of longevity.
Well, our name is our story, too. I mean, our story is embedded in our name.
Yes.
You know, it comes with me uniquely. Mm-hmm. This is my story attached to my name.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Go ahead, sir.
I just was going to comment on the, just how much I appreciate the subtlety and the skill with which you create characters in this story. One character that I sort of wondered, jarred a little bit with me, was the chaplain. And, you know, there was an assumption on Robert's part, which was interesting to me, that chaplain must have, you know, faith and believe in the afterlife, and that makes his experience of seeing somebody getting ready to die is, you know, that's not maybe as maybe it doesn't affect him so much. He knows where that baby's going or something. And I thought, you know, as somebody who is member of a church, I know many of us don't know where that baby is going. I mean, that's an image that Robert has of what a chaplain must believe, and I thought that was it was interesting that was his perception of it. It made me think
about it. It's his version of relativity, right? Oh, it's easier for you because you have a connection.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So, but thank you.
Yes, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Mine's just more of a statement, sort of ironic. I know the story you said came to fruition 2015. 2015 in January, I was a patient at the Beth Israel. And my roommate was a 94-year-old Holocaust survivor.
Oh.
She lived on Washington Street in Brookline.
All right.
We became great, great friends. Her birthday was a day after mine. It was a joke. She was on her way to get a Holocaust survivor award. She fell. She hit her head, but survived. She wound up going into assisted living. But you go back to this silence. I'm Irish. There's this sort of code of silence in the Irish, too. Once you break that code of silence, you're never forgiven. So she must have seen this vulnerability in my eyes. We stayed great friends. I used to go see her in the assisted living, and she wound up dying, too, in November. And I cannot erase her voicemail from my phone. That's what an impact she made. But that's a true story, and I couldn't believe it when I read your story.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I just saw the announcement of this session an hour and a half ago, so I have not read the story.
Okay.
But there are a lot of people here who could share, maybe, experiences that they had with Holocaust survivors and those who regret after the death of the Holocaust survivor what they did or didn't do in relation to that person. In other words, how do I, who am the stepson of a Holocaust survivor, deal with the sons of the Holocaust survivor who have very troubled relationships with their mother, and she's now 87. And I'm wondering if there is a way of treating people who deal with Holocaust survivors so that the burden will be lessened on them after the Holocaust survivor's death.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other aspect of this, the children of help. My cousin studies this, actually. And I mean, I've just witnessed this with my aunt, who actually is a Holocaust survivor herself, but she was a baby, right? So for her, it's been this really fraught, it was a fraught relationship, you know? And I think the fact of carrying, it's a burden, it's passed along. My cousin, whose father survived life in a camp, she said, "It's secondhand smoke," she said. "It's growing up, right? It's you've absorbed it or inhaled it, and that's our burden, though. That is our burden. And what you do with it, for me, I'm writing stories. Everybody finds a different way.
And your grandmother seems to have been the farthest thing from a self-defeating and counterproductive person, but so many of the Holocaust survivors have that troubled relationship with their own families, and just wondering if there was anything that you had to comment on that piece.
Thank you.
I thank you for your story. It was very moving, your story, on a lot of levels. And so beyond the characters and what we've been talking about, I was just curious, with the form that you're using of short story, the other thing that impressed me beyond the emotional story, which really touched me, was the structure of your story. It almost felt like unpacking a puzzle, and it felt very symmetrical, and you were alluding to some of that in your themes. But my question is, like, how intentional or conscious are you of that? It really felt very, very well structured. Very, you know, it very, you know, ended on a point that I didn't see coming, and that happened a couple times during the story. So it was almost like you had really diagrammed it out. But I'm wondering how conscious it was when you were writing it, or editing it.
Yes, so I'm conscious of the sections and the white space between those sections, and I felt kind of the waves, and I knew, for instance, that introducing the baby was going to happen after introducing Robert and one of his clients. I knew that. I didn't know quite when, and then it became sort of almost like a feeling, almost like a rhythm of a breath of, okay, this is where we pause now and we go back to Robert and Katie. I will say, you know, when I sent that story to my literary agency, the agent said, you know, what's going on? Why are you waiting so long to say? And I said, just forget it. give me my story back. Right. So it was very important. I felt like, to me, that felt like an organic movement. But for somebody who's more impatient or young, I think maybe it's not natural. And in terms of the ending, I didn't originally have exactly that ending. I knew it ended with Robert and Roja together somehow, and it was something about her saying that she was going, that it was time for her to be going too. I remember the original ending said something like, you know, he went on to his next client, or he had somewhere else to go or to be. And then at some point, I got to that line. I just said, no, it's that she was still here. And then I heard that line, I knew that was it. But it did take probably many, many tries.
Yeah. It definitely left me with the impression at the end of an author who had really considered the arc and the setups and the resolutions. And it was very satisfying to have it end that way, along with the emotion in the characters as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ditto on the ending. I love that it ended on a light note, on an up note, because it balanced the heaviness. Two things I want to say. A good story for me is when it reminds me of something. And someone mentioned about the complaints of and comparison. Mm-hmm. It really reminded me of working in the prisons where I remember the alcoholics always used to say, well, at least I'm not a drug addict. And the drug addicts always used to say, at least I'm not an alcoholic. And a question. The fulcrum of the story seems, or a really central point, is that Robert is someone whose baby is dying. You mentioned Roja being from your grandmother. Where does that come from?
The baby dying?
Yes, as a central.
You know, a few different kind of anecdotes of hearing about a child either stillborn or, and specifically I did hear of a child who was born with just a lot of things wrong, yes, and that it took a number of days, and that to me was also kind of a miracle. So the sadness of it, but also this kind of miraculous thing that had happened.
Thank you very much for
the
story.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. Hi.
Thank you for your story. One of the things that I thought about reading it is, you know, obviously the Holocaust survivors are a passing generation.
And I grew up, my parents were in Greece during World War II. They were not part of the Holocaust, but they underwent a lot of hardship and starvation, and they survived. And I grew up with those stories, but my father passed away. I realized my children don't have a sense of that, which I guess, you know, you have from your grandparents and your parents, but is there any way that the next generation is going to, you know?
Right. No, I know. I think about this a lot. If you look at the One City, One Story page on the web, they have resources listed at the bottom, and one of them is this program I didn't know about called Facing History and Ourselves, which is wonderful, and they go in and teach youngsters, right? And I think that's how that's going to be passed along, is actually with people facilitating that conversation and bringing in survivors who can speak to, which I know my roommate was saying, oh yeah, my one living grandparent, she goes and speaks to young people. So that's our hope, right? Or people writing about it, I guess.
Thank you very much. And also for your wonderful speaking about how short stories are the pauses and the breaths that a novel would either make much more sweeping or much tinier. So you write both, and I'm interested in what kind of a breath this would be in a novel if you included or either turned the short story into a novel, or would it just be...
Oh,
a teeny bit.
If this were a novel?
Yeah. Pardon me if that's not a relevant question.
I can't even imagine. You know, for me, it's like I see something, I think that's a story, or I think, oh, that's a novel. So, yeah, I am.
Would it be like if you had written this in first person?
That's a great, I mean, I would have to inhabit probably Robert in a certain way. And I didn't hear, you know, I heard it in the third person, so it's interesting, right? Some things seem to me delivered in a certain form, but that's what I love about stories. I felt I could contain this. Yes?
Since this was inspired by your grandmother and possibly other relatives, did any of them read the story, either in development or after it was after you published it?
Yes. So that was nice to have this sort of sent. My father emailed it to everybody. So, yes.
Did your grandmother in particular get to read it?
Yes, but you know, only at the very end, because I hadn't sent it to her because she was so really not reading. And then I actually, when I was calling in the last week of her life, I heard my dad in the back explaining, and he had brought it for her. So,
right.
Yes. And she actually said, well, I got to read it soon. So, yes.
But, you know, yes. just before we go on, I want to readdress your question about have you ever thought about this as a novel or writing it in first person? Because I want to encourage you in your thinking along those lines. You know, those are really good questions. And, I mean, I feel like I want to say to you, okay, Daphne, go write it in first person. You know? it's such a kind of a good exercise, even though it's not what you envisioned. You know? I mean, imagine what to take your thing and say, I'm going to look at it this way now.
Yes.
I mean, imagine what would come of that in a way. I mean, no one's asking you to do that,
but I'm
saying it's such a good idea. It's really a good idea to think about your writing that way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. I mean, it would feel completely foreign to me, but yes, it would be a different creature.
Anyway, I just didn't want you to go away thinking that what you had said was some egregious suggestion.
Oh, No. I can't, yes.
Okay, good. Okay, I'm sorry for taking...
No problem. Two things. One is a comment. My husband and I are both grandchildren of Armenian genocide survivors. So we had four wonderful grandmothers who definitely channeled your grandmother. So, and when I read it, I was just put back. Even though you didn't give much description of the apartment, it put me right into my grandmother's old apartment and visual. So just your character description took me back. So thank you for that. And I think your grandmother represents a lot of grandmothers.
Yes.
The other question I had is the onion. The onion that...
she shared, that the girl shared with her at the concentration camp that helped heal her sores. I know she gave Robert the meatloaf, in essence, to heal his sores, but she also had sores. And I didn't know if there was a little hopefulness there that when he ate the meatloaf, if her sores would disappear and she would live on. Yes. Oh, that's what I yes. chose. I just didn't know if it was intentional yes. or if you had a double meaning there.
Yeah, again, not consciously, but afterwards, I definitely was thinking about that. So, yes.
So we need to wind down, but I have one other thing I want to say to you, Daphne, and that is, you know, we talked about the mystery or the magic of life and death, you know, of nature and of human cruelty, but we didn't talk about the magic or mystery of survival, you know, and each of us probably has a story of loss, you know, from one tragedy or small or large in your lives. But the one thing, in addition to that, that we all have in common is that we all survive every day in that magic and in that mystery. And I think that this story places us as readers, as survivors, you know. And I can't speak to surviving the Holocaust, but I have my own story of survival, mm-hmm. and I'm sure you have one, and mm-hmm. each of you has one, whether you're Jewish or Irish or Boston or mm-hmm. a Washingtonian or whatever you are from California, you know. I just want to thank you for putting us in that place to remind ourselves that we share loss and love and hope and survival with each other. So thank that's you. A true gift.
Thank you so much. Thanks to everybody. Thank you.